Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors. Welcome to Sell It to the City, and I'm your host, Tamsin Freeman. And this is an event where private investors pitch their best stock idea to city fund managers. And the idea came about from a tweet from Andy Brough at Schroders. And I think it was on the back of the stock challenge, a retail investor challenge, where Andy said, maybe I should have an information forum where people pitch ideas to fund managers. Could be like Judgment Day in reverse. Any other fund managers up for it? And I'm thrilled to say they were. And we've got a fabulous panel of fund managers with Andy Brough from Schroders, Judith McKenzie from Downing, and Stephen English from Stellar Asset Management. And we've got four very brave retail investors with John Marriott, who goes on Twitter as F15JCM, and Rebecca Stewart, who we all know as Aston Girl, and Ryan Rahim Akia, who's also known as Ryan Keir 2 on Twitter, and Richard Crowe, also known as Cockney Rebel. And tonight we'll find out whose idea will delight and whose idea will be doomed. Or maybe none of them are, because they're all such good ideas. So how it's going to work is that each investor has 5 minutes to pitch their idea. And then the fund managers have 3 minutes to ask questions. And then at the end of that, they will give a score both for the quality of the pitch and the quality of the stock idea. And then, of course, we'll have a winner. And the winner will come back to the next Sell It to the City. So we're all ready to kick off. And first of all, we'll go to John Marriott. John, are you ready?
Evening all. This evening, I'm going to pitch to you Brave Bison, ticker BBSN, which is an AIM-listed stock. Brave Bison is a new era media and marketing group that specialises in social media. Brave Bison combines a leading social marketing agency and content studio with a media network of over 650 channels and 158 million followers. The company is headquartered in London with additional offices in Singapore. Next slide, please. Market cap of £17.5 million with an approximate net cash balance of £2 million, giving an enterprise value of £15.5 million. Share price, when I looked earlier today, you're buying at 1.7 pence, able to sell for 1.55, or you can probably deal well inside that spread, I suspect. The stock's up 52% over the last 12 months. They recently made an acquisition of a company called Greenlight, which I'm going to come on to. But including the acquisition, we're looking at a pro forma annual revenue of £30 million. Trailing 12-month adjusted EBITDA of £1 million. So that's H2 of last year and the first half of this year. And the company is also profitable on a GAAP basis. I am going to use EBITDA numbers quite a lot through this presentation. Bit of buy and build strategy. There's quite a lot of amortization that's relevant, and also it makes it easier to compare to peers, but I do think EBITDA is actually a valid metric here. 2022 forecast EBITDA of £2.6 million, which when we're talking about an EV of only £15.5 million, you can see that we're talking about a fairly low rated stock here. Now, the stock does have quite a low free float, with only about 35% of the stock is free float. Oliver Green and his brother Theo, they have a holding post the placing for the acquisition of around 22.5%. Now, some of that's made up through companies they're directors of, and some of the shares are actually owned directly by themselves, but in aggregate, 22.5%. Now, the addressable market of the digital area that they're in, The global digital advertising market is expected to grow at a compound annual growth rate of circa 14% over the period 2019 to 2024. This growth is supported by the proliferation and adoption of technology platforms worldwide. According to current market research, social media, influencer marketing, SEO and paid search, all core to the enlarged Brave Bison group, are some of the most dynamic subsegments within the fast-growing digital advertising space. Next slide, please. Okay, so the channels that Brave Bison have are just some of the more prominent ones. They do have a lot. I think I mentioned at the top that they've got over 650 channels. There's one called the Wave House. So please bear in mind that these are targeted at quite a youthful audience, and I'm certainly well past their demographic now. But the Wave House is like a content influencer, sort of reality kind of environment. They've got 4.1 million TikTok subscribers. There's another channel called The Hook. I did actually know some of the people were on there. There's quite a few interviews with film stars when films are launched, etc. They're at 7.5 million Facebook subscribers and nearly a million Instagram subscribers. There's another DIY channel. That's actually the largest one with 27.6 million subscribers on there. I'm going to have to come on to the valuation now because time's going quite quickly. So Greenlight was acquired in August 2021. £6.8 million, of which £6 million will be cash, £1 million in shares, and £750,000 deferred. Oliver and his brother Theo putting in £1 million, another £1 million in the placing. Greenlight works with large blue-chip clients such as Dixon's Carphone, Gap, Furniture Village, New Balance, etc. Clients typically sign multi-year retainer agreements, and Greenlight benefits from a high proportion of recurring revenue, estimated at 73% this financial year. Greenlight will build on the existing footprint on key advertising platforms such as Google, Facebook, TikTok, and Snapchat, and expand onto platforms such as Amazon, SAP, Salesforce, and BigCommerce. For revenue, 14.3 million in the last financial year, EBIT 800,000. The Cenkos research note says that combining the two businesses will give synergies of £250,000. So we're looking at adding 1.1 million to the group's adjusted EBITDA from last year. So that will have 2.1 million pro forma for this financial year, and that is expected to rise to 2.6 million in FY22.
Can you summarise? Because we're running out of time.
Yeah, absolutely. Why do I like the stock? It's a young and ambitious management team. Ollie Green's only 28. I think that's quite a positive thing given the young demographic that they're engaging with. It's a genuine turnaround play. New management has delivered a cost-saving program, which has seen the business achieve cash generation and build a gap on EBITDA basis. I think this is a sign of management competence, which is yet to be reflected in the valuation. There's some previous integration experience from integration of The Hook in April 2020. It's a net cash balance, so there's no pressure from debt to be serviced. Looking at a very modest valuation of less than 6x pro forma adjusted EBITDA, 24% growth, and that's giving a PEG ratio of only 0.25, which I think looks incredibly attractive. Management very well with shareholders. There doesn't seem to be much coverage of the stock. It's not one that gets talked about on Twitter or in the media at the moment, so there's always a possibility of a herd arriving at a later date if things continue to go well.
We're well over time.
Okay. Hopefully we can cover some of the other stuff in the questions.
Okay. So, Andy, Judith, Stephen, any questions?
Yeah, well, I'll kick off. That's right. The other two. I mean, how do they actually make money? Do you actually understand? Because you've given us a lot of buzz phrases, which I've vaguely heard of, things like Facebook, social media, and all this sort of stuff. But how do they actually make money? Have you got a clear idea?
Okay. So they are an ad agency in a traditional sense, in one aspect of the business. So they have clients on retainers. They bring in some revenue from the content put onto the social media channels. So they get a slice of the advertised revenue that brings in. And they do actually like create content to order as well, if you like. So there's like a production aspect to the bill. I wasn't actually able to get a breakdown of how the revenue split between those different facets of the business. I don't know if that, I didn't look at the previous Cenkos note, but I don't know if that may be in there.
And Judith, you had a question.
Yeah, I do. I want to talk about ethics and governance, I suppose. So when it's been obviously in the press quite a bit that a lot of that kind of push for advertising going through Facebook and social media channels is using influencers, but also influencing young kids and even older kids in the wrong way. So it's covert advertising, really. What's your view on that?
Undeniably, the business is very focused on the influencer kind of scene. Certainly, if you look at the website of the business and the group, you'll see that given the demographic they are targeting, there is quite a focus on things like sustainability and that kind of thing. There's like the DIY channel, there's another one called Mother, which is focused on sort of home life. But I get the impression it is quite an ethically run business. The concerns you make and sort of negative connotations around influence and may be valid. But I see that as more of a sectoral thing rather than specific to the business itself.
And what about the nice element of keeping it in the family with Ollie and his brother being on the board? I think they used to have another member as well on the board at one stage. There's not a lot of independence when it comes to the non-execs either.
Yes, true. I must admit, my strategy to investing isn't really focused around corporate governance. I run a small business myself, and I like engaged board members. I like people who are at the coalface. I like people who are very ambitious. I could see that as a positive. Others, particularly running other people's money, I guess, may look at that from a different perspective.
Stephen, we are at 3 minutes of questions, but if you have a burning question, we could squeeze it in.
The name change to Brave Bison, it was to purposely serve to challenge the way it is thought of by brands, creators and commercial partners. Definitely job done there. It's probably challenge investors as well. I'm invested in Mission Group and STV, and I know a lot of the hype around digital return on investment is overhyped, and in fact the payoff is a lot better for TV and radio. I suppose my question would be, what is their, because they are small scale, what is their burning USP to compete against the big boys who very much have a very developed digital strategy?
USP. I would say that the USP is that they're very much focused on youthful audiences. So if you look at the platforms they're on, things like TikTok particularly, I get the impression I don't use it. At 38, I think they're really focusing in on that youth market, the teens and 20s.
Thank you very much indeed, John. And we'll go first to Andy. Andy, can you give us a critique on the pitch and the quality of the stock, and then give us a score out of 5 for both?
Okay, well, I think Stephen made the best point, really, in that how do you compete in this sector? You know, you get a lot of small companies who actually believe in their own hype. They've got a fantastic product. and they think they're going to rule the world. But, you know, you've got to be someone like Martin Sorrell to do that, or have an established position like STV. And the trouble about making acquisition from being a small company is, you know, what are you actually buying? So I think, you know, your assets go up and down in the lift, and there's always a danger with these things that you don't actually get the returns. It's not a company I've come across in my time in the markets. I've seen more of these small companies go bust and actually make it. So for both, I'm going to give a score of 2 out of 5.
Thank you very much indeed. Judith, going straight over to you.
Well, despite what I was maybe saying, I do quite like the sector. We play it through a little company called Digital Box that probably punches slightly higher than its weight, because they own their own titles like The Tag, which is for university students, and The Daily Mash, which is satire. And that's quite attractive because you are a bit like a mini future. Here, I think my concern would be the volatility of earnings, because you are absolutely at the whim of the likes of Facebook and Twitter, who change their algorithms. And if they change their cookies, also another threat in the sector, then you can get really bouncy earnings. And actually, it's quite difficult to forecast as well. So not, I don't think it's a quality business as such. And therefore, I would be giving it a 3 out of 5, although I do quite like the sector.
And for the quality of the pitch?
Quality of the pitch, same again.
Thank you very much indeed. And Stephen, over to you.
I mean, my social media is MySpace, chatting to me mate Tom, me single mate Tom on MySpace every weekend. So probably not the best person on this, but I thought the pitch was good on the financial aspect of it. I think if you balance that out more with the commercial side and the model, and also maybe on the risk side as well, I appreciate it's such a hard thing to do in such a limited time period. As to the company itself, I do like turnarounds. It's still too early stage for me. These business models tend to have to constantly be evolving as technology evolves. And as Judith alluded to, things change all the time. So I can't hang my hat on what this company is going to be doing in 3 years or 5 years, let alone 10 years. So summing up, I think quality of the pitch, 3. Quality of the company, 2.
So summing up, thank you very much, all three of you, and thank you, John. And so we have 8 for the quality of the company and 7 for the quality of the pitch. And thank you very much indeed. So we'll now go to Rebecca Stewart, who'll present Springfield Properties, ticker SPR. Reb, over to you.
Thank you. Hello, and welcome to Springfield Properties. First slide, please. Springfield Properties is Scotland's leading listed house builder. It listed on AIM back in October 2017 at a price of 106 pence. It's got a market cap of 147 million and a 43% free float. The founding family, the Adams family, have significant skin in the game with a 46.58% holding. I'm a big fan of founder-led businesses. The company is chaired by Sandy Adam, with CEO Innes Smith and CFO Michelle Motion. It operates in 2 sectors: private housing, which makes up 72% of the revenue, and affordable housing, which makes up 28%. They're also acquisitive as they expand through Scotland, having bought Dawn Homes in 2017, who specialise on the west coast of Scotland, and Walker Group in 2019, who operate in the Central Belt, and they bought in 2019 for 31 million. Here you can see their Stockopedia summary page, showing the price over the last year on the graph, showing a steady growth, flattening off, and currently a slight decline, possibly due to interest rate rises risk. In summary, they're on a PE of 8.8, a price earnings growth of 0.5. They yield a decent dividend at 4.32% at the current market price of 144 pence. And their stock rank, which is a ratio comprising a quality metric, value momentum metric, comes through at a very strong 90 out of a possible 100. In addition, they passed two long stock screens. Okay, so looking at the financials, you'll see steady growth since listing. And looking ahead on forecasts for 2022 and 2023 financial years on average, we've got growth forecast in revenue at 19%, net profit at 27.5%, and earnings per share at 19.6%. You'll notice a slight COVID blip back in 2020, but they're now back on track, and their debt has reduced down to 20.8 million. To summarise the bull and bear case, the bull case is we have a leading, acquisitive, strongly growing and well-run company. They're founder-led with a significant family holding. They've been realising value in their large land bank via sales to other house builders, which included 200 plots sold last year in the Central Belt to two UK-listed house builders. They've also got private housing villages, which are proving increasingly popular post-lockdown as families look for green spaces and facilities like schools and local shops. They've also underpinned by the Affordable Housing Division, with the Scottish Government's current policy to build 50,000 affordable homes in Scotland by 2021. There's also a new opportunity in the retail private rental sector through an agreement that they've signed with Sigma Capital Growth, whereby they build the houses for Sigma, who then buy them and rent them to the private rental sector. And their July trading update stated that revenue and profit would be, my favourite expression, significantly ahead. The bear case is they are operating in a cyclical industry sector, being house building. There's risk of cost and supply pressures in labour and raw materials, as so many other companies are saying at the moment. There is uncertainty over another potential Scottish independence referendum. There's no female non-exec directors. The CEO and chair have had significant share sales, although this is an opportunity for institutional investors who wish to buy in. And I don't believe they're well known in the city, which is why I've brought them here to you today. Thank you.
Many thanks, Reb. And Judith, do you have any questions?
Yes, I do. I think you highlighted one of maybe the areas of concern that I would have, and that is the threat of good old Scottish independence or bad old Scottish independence. And how do you price in the risk around planning changes in that event, especially in the private rental sector?
Well, they've certainly got framework agreements with the majority of the local authorities throughout Scotland. So that gives them their bread and butter for continuing to build the affordable housing that sort of underpins the company. But there is obviously risk going forward on legislation, I agree. But I guess their agreement with Sigma would give them a certain degree of certainty because they have contracts to build for Sigma.
Thank you very much. And Stephen, do you have any questions?
Yeah, fascinating business. Are you worried at all about the balance sheet? I mean, they have de-risked it with those land sales, but if they are going to be further acquisitive of other companies, are they looking to run a net debt structural position, which is in contrast to pretty much everyone else in that sector whose balance sheets potentially are overbloated with net cash?
Yeah, that's true. And it's a good question. They certainly are acquisitive. They want to grow. Sandy is very ambitious as a chair, because I know him. So yes, I would say they will be looking to run. They do have a revolving credit facility, which they've just renewed going out to 2025, I believe. So I think we could expect to see further acquisitions, but I take on board your point, particularly if interest rates are going to rise.
Thank you very much. And Andy, any questions?
Yeah, you highlight the sort of raw materials, but I mean, it's fascinating that, you know, timber kits are 90% of the completions in this company. And, you know, you only have to look at the graph of timber prices this year. And I just wonder whether you think that's behind the fact that, you know, their margins, when I look at other house builders in the sector, are much lower, actually. You know, I can get sort of 23, 24% from the Bellways, et cetera, this world. Why would I take the risk, really, of having a 90% timber-framed development-led house builder in Scotland?
You do know that they obviously have fixed-price contracts at the moment across their timber. And also 45% of all of the houses are built in their own factory as opposed to being externally built, which I think gives them a degree of control as well. Oh, and I should add that 15% of their workforce are under apprenticeships too, which I like.
Thank you, Reb. So, Stephen, coming to you, give us your thoughts on the quality of the stock and also the quality of the pitch, and give us a score for each out of five.
Yeah, I have dabbled in MJ Gleeson and Pearson in the past, and this one does remind me of a mini version of MJ Gleeson. I think they've done well with the strategic land bank. So a little bit worried about the balance sheet, albeit mitigated, does seem to have very good visibility, the certain nuances of the Scottish market. That said, it is a very, very cyclical sector. So quality of the company, 3 for me. Quality of the presentation, Reb, I thought it was nicely balanced. I thought you teased out the key points in the short time that you had, so 4.
Thank you very much. And Judith, going to you.
Clearly, I know the Scottish market, and I know quite a number of these sites as well. So I think the overall quality of the build and the popularity of what they're churning out is good. But from a company perspective, I think structurally, I think Stephen touched on some of the points there on debt. They don't really have much firepower for new deals. And that sort of operational aspect too, where, you know, you don't really have the best breed margins in the sector. So on the company and the quality of the company, I would also give it a 3. However, on the pitch, I agree with Stephen, very succinctly driven, delivered and got to the points very quickly. So I would give 4 for the pitch.
Thank you very much. And for you, Andy?
Well, I think you've got the house builders only really do well when they've got sort of growing populations. And I think you've got the danger of a shrinking population in Scotland if you're going to get taxes, et cetera, going up. And very few of the major house builders are up there really for that reason. And I, in this sector, I'm a large holder of MJ Gleeson because I think they've got a better spread. Businesses, better balance sheets, and I just think it's a better company. But, you know, it's one that I shall keep an eye on. So company 2, pitch 3.
Tremendous. So, Reb, that means for the stock, you got 8 out of a possible 15, and for the delivery, 11 out of a possible 15. So, tremendous. Well done. Thank you very much indeed. And now we go to Ryan, who'll present TransferWise, ticker WISE. Ryan, over to you.
So the company I'll be pitching today for this first slide is called Wise. It's a firm that had just £2 million worth of revenues back in 2014, but now for its most recent financial year had £421 million of revenues. And those revenues are expected to grow by 27.9% in the coming financial year. And for the same period, Wise is also expected to almost double its profit after tax to £58.6 million. Now, when we think about disruptive tech companies listing on the London Stock Exchange, the first thing that comes to mind is them being grossly overvalued using comparisons to big tech in the US. Well, I think Wise is an odd one out. So what does Wise actually do? Well, their main business allows people to send and receive money overseas. And the other question would be, how does it make money? Well, it charges fees for processing payments across 56 different currencies. A bit of research carried out back in April 2021 called the Electronic Data Capture Market Study showed that PayPal, a firm that recently surpassed a $300 billion market cap, charges around 6.7 times what TransferWise is charging, 0.69% on average per transaction, the diagram in the bottom left, at the beginning of Q4 2021. And the main difference between Wise and, say, a large competitor like PayPal is that you can send money using only an email on PayPal, but require bank details for Wise. And PayPal has an online shop integration, but Wise does not have this yet. And in the last 3 years, Wise has doubled its total personal customer account numbers and has tripled its total business customer numbers. Wise also has only a 2.5% market share of all personal international transfers worldwide and 0.6% of combined personal and business transfers. Unlike its peers, Wise has created a culture of radical transparency with respect to its pricing. As a customer, you don't even need to sign up to estimate rates and fees. The platform even has a built-in comparison tool to see what Wise charges versus its competitor. The image in the middle. Next slide, please. How do other competitors perform? Well, Wise is more efficient and more functional than any other fintech alternative out there. Wise takes the least time to initially register and send money, up to half the time taken in comparison to using a competitor such as PayPal's Xoom, as shown in the first diagram on the left. Wise also leads the pack in terms of platform functionality. It is heavily invested into its API, which can be flexible, creating the path for further features such as commercial integration for online shopping, as its largest competitor, PayPal, seems to dominate. And for the third image on screen, it has also grown its cross-border total consumer volumes in US dollars at a rate faster than any other competitor. And if the current rate of growth keeps up, Wise could soon take over the total quarterly volumes transacted by Western Union's digital arm. Could we have the next slide, please? So for risks, it may be the case that regulators increase restrictions on fintech, and that in turn would restrict the release of new products and revenue sources. If the growth that you'd expect of these fast-moving tech companies, especially in the UK, isn't kept up at the rate that the market expects, the high valuation multiples that it's currently trading on could reduce themselves drastically, affecting Wise's valuation. And there's also a chance that we're in an environment where everything is going towards zero. They use this fees will soon be zero methodology when describing anything from ETFs to even simply paying for things in different currencies. Well, Wise has acknowledged this, and at the moment it isn't much of a risk, because using the past 3 years of financial data, when you'd expected average take rates to fall, actually the average take rates charged by Wise per transaction have increased. For the next slide and final slide, we want to ask ourselves, why is Wise a good investment? Well, the market share relative to the target addressable market suggests that there is a long way to go. Wise recently launched a new feature called Assets for Investing, addressing quite a popular niche right now, in which they charge a 0.4% annual service fee, which it will soon, once this is fully expanded, it will soon be able to charge on up to £4.3 billion worth of client funds. Wise can also use its flexible API to introduce new functions, but also introduce offline business, which PayPal has done, but Wise has currently £0 worth of revenue from. And unlike traditional IPOs, Wise didn't raise any money back when they did their IPO via a direct listing on the 7th of July, 2021. In fact, management said that they had over £286.1 million of its own cash, and so didn't need to issue any shares. And given the company is already profitable and has been since 2017, a move not to raise when easily accessible could be viewed as a responsible decision for management. Normally, when companies are able to raise capital, they tend to. When they opt not to, this is something that, at least from a management perspective, I found interesting. Wise shares also have a significantly tight float, with almost 30% of its shares remaining held by the company's co-founders. 70% of the total shares available, that float is held right now, and 64% of all of its shares are held by just 8 of its top investors. Wise also introduced something recently called its ADR, or the ticker symbol's WISE. It's through an OTC listing in the US. And that has opened up the chance for thematic ETF managers looking to purchase shares in an already tight share float to expand their portfolios. And the final diagram that we have up shows that PayPal, the largest competitor in this industry, as we said, the $300 billion market cap, has been losing market share from 2012's 24% total market share to a 16% market share in 2020. If you're looking to back winners in the fintech industry, Wise has grown at a rate faster than any competitor and has self-funded its ambitious growth plans. And for that reason, I believe Wise could be a worthwhile investment for an investor's portfolio.
Many thanks, Ryan. Stephen, coming straight to you, do you have any questions?
Not an expert in this area. I do hold AlphaFX, have done, thankfully, since IPO. They're building a burgeoning payments business within there. But when I'm not an expert, I'll turn to an expert. And Mark Rubenstein covered Wise in an excellent piece for his Net Interest newsletter. And I think the nub of it for me is is there a virtuous circle for reducing your take rate and passing on lower costs via lower fees? Does that encourage you to transact more volume on a cross-border basis? Or if you're remitting it to a family, is there a finite ceiling to that remittance? So regardless of if the take rate is 70 basis points or 20, you're not going to be remitting anymore. And I think that's the key nub of it. And their declared mission is for their currency exchange services to be eventually free. And I'm trying to square that circle between an investment for a shareholder and shareholder returns. So the question for me is, because they're not a bank and their deposits of over 4 billion are not insured, they can't offer credit, which is the kind of normal end game for a fintech, is to move to that adjacency of credit provision. What does that do to the investment case, or indeed, do you think they will become a bank?
Well, actually, that's a really good question. In the most recent release from the company, they said, we don't intend on ever being a bank. So as you said, those risks are totally valid. But the approach that Wise is taking versus, say, a WorldRemit or any other business that we could think of as their competitors is more on innovation of product offering. Because if eventually there could be a point where that main business that they have now of currency transfer and remittances isn't even the main part of the business. The assets idea almost is going in light of a similar broker kind of style, but they've done a smart twist on it. Instead of offering stocks or things like that, they're offering ETFs through BlackRock's iShares, or one of their ETFs. And that has access to all sorts of companies like stocks. And that can, whilst their AUM is growing, they can have an additional route. And the part of commercialization, which PayPal has done so well, the API of which Wise has is very flexible. If they can implement some form of system, which I think is quite likely, then that unlocks a totally different market. And this whole payments idea is just one of many different revenue sources.
Thank you very much. Andy, have you got any questions?
Yeah, we've seen these fintechs spring up, haven't we? Whether it's Wise or Klarna and Hargreaves Lansdown or whatever. And now it seems to me that the big banks suddenly recognise that, I'm the Lloyds Bank bank manager. I'm being valued at 34 billion, and this Klarna thing's 45 billion, and Wise Group's 10.3. What happens? And so, A, how concerned are you that the big banks get their act together? And B, how am I really going to make money from here from a PE of 158?
That's a very good point. Well, firstly, to answer your question about the banks, The term of innovation, Wise has been around from, I think, 2014. They had 2 million of revenue, and now obviously they're growing at a very fast rate. Now, in that 7 years, the freedom that you have by not being a bank and not having the regulators on your back and being able to invest money knowing that it might not return something significantly, that the layers of, what do they call them, bureaucracy, that's the term, in banks is something that might be a whole lot more difficult for them to just change their entire business model. But in terms of valuation for Wise, I, as an investor in Wise, don't see this as being a 20% CAGR a year or a 30% CAGR a year stock. I'm thinking more in terms of addressing new markets and it having systems that work in those payments markets and simply being a key player in those markets as well, and multiple other markets. So with commercial payments, for some reason, could be a totally different market to what we address. Now, at the moment, Wise sends £1 in every £40 of personal transfers. Wise has 68% of its users coming from word of mouth. A business that seems to focus on customer service can really, in my mind, release any product as long as it is done correctly and then address a totally new market. So it's almost like I'm not investing into Wise just because of the payments platform, but more the upside in terms of diversification of revenue routes.
Thank you. And coming to you, Judith, what question do you have?
Yeah, I think it's been a really attractive sector, but I also think there's been a massive land grab in the sector too over the last 3 or 4 years, and the banks will wake up at some point. Whether they can do anything about it, I'm not quite so sure. I think they probably will acquire, but I think my question is more about the ultimate return on invested capital, because I think these businesses are going to have to invest and innovate so much more than they have done in the past. And you almost alluded to it in the products and solutions rollouts that you've talked about. So, if I look at the analyst forecasts, the actual cash deployment and development spend looks, I think, a little bit light. Have you got any comment on that?
I think the one thing that I find really fascinating about Wise is they have self-funded all growth ambitions. The assets launched, self-funded, no placing like you see with any other company that comes to the market. A lot of companies that are going public, they opt for how much can we allocate to institutional investors, raise, issue shares. Wise opted for a direct listing, which is very rare. And given its status, you'd expect they should have raised a couple billion and it probably would have been taken up. Given especially how light the UK's tech sector is in terms of quality companies in the tech sector. But my concern wouldn't be in that area. And the reason why I don't have a concern is its products that it already has, it has grown off its own pocket. So it seems like capital allocation is efficient. And I like this bit where the top two founders, the co-founders, own just over 30% of its stock. So in terms of decision-making, it remains quite centralized. And you have another investor as well, A16Z, Andreessen Horowitz, a famous VC fund that also has around 10% there. And it almost seems that at the moment, they're not trying to lose control. And the ambitions are very different, which most tech companies tend to go and fight against each other. When you look at TransferWise's market share in terms of those quarterly volumes being transacted for personal transaction, for example, they are growing at a faster rate than anyone else. And they're on track to be the market leader, which four, five, six years ago, they didn't even exist. And a lot of these companies have been around for tens, maybe even 100 or so years, such as Western Union.
Thank you very much. So, Stephen, coming to you, can you give us a view on what you think of TransferWise and also on the pitch and a score for each?
I like the really long runway they've got from a market share point of view today. I'm still trying to get my head around whether that virtuous circle of lowering your fees will drive more volume. 40% of their register users do lapse into inactivity. So you have to keep feeding the machine. And it's full of options. It has to move into adjacencies. Further it goes away from its core, yeah, are they going to be any good with an investment side of things? It's very different to doing cross-border FX. Facebook was going to dabble in dating, online dating, and then suddenly pull back from it. Focus is everything for a business. So a little bit worried about that. So weighing it all up at a 3 for the company. And in terms of the overall pitch, Ryan, I thought that was very, very, very good. Really calm, really measured, covered a heck of a lot of ground. Without seemingly talking fast at all. So you've got a skill there. So 4 for the quality of the pitch.
Tremendous. Thank you very much indeed. And Andy, your views.
Yeah, no, I agree with Stephen there. I thought the pitch was excellent. I thought, you know, actually giving us a whole picture of where the company fits in the ecosystem, how it makes money, the risk, the reward, and, you know, a nice fast-paced sort of take through it. My concern is, you know, we've seen it with Hargreaves Lansdown rolling over. We've seen it with ASOS, Boohoo. You get into a market position and then, you know, actually you haven't invested enough, you know, taking due to this point. And then you can't actually get the returns in the competition. You know, the old economy stocks wake up. So while I love the pitch for a 4, it's a 1 for me for the company.
Thank you very much. And Judith?
I'm probably not going to say much more than the other two have said in terms of where the company sits and some of the challenges that I have. I think what I would say, I kind of feel as though it's a bit kind of top of the market stuff. You know, there has been a land grab. It's on a fairly punchy forward multiple. And I would probably say that the shareholders have been pretty smart in terms of their own marketing as well. If you look at the PR that came out around about the time of the IPO, it was dressed ready to go to the party and certainly came with a bit of a bang. And my cynicism would say that they didn't actually take any money out or raise any money at that point because they were building it as a little bit of a story, really. And, you know, they've done that well. They've done it very well. So I would give it a 2, mainly discounted for its valuation and where it sits as opposed to the overall sector, which I think is just going to be right with consolidation at some point. It's about trying to back the right winner. winner in that case, or a winner. And I would agree with everybody else about the pitch as well. You know the company really well, and that comes across. And you delivered exceptionally well too, so I would go for a 4.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. And well done, Ryan. So for the stock, it's 6 out of 15. And for the delivery, it's 12 out of 15. So congratulations on that. So we'll now go to Richard Crowe, who will present Crichton's ticker, CRL. Richard, over to you.
Okay. The ticker is CRL. The name is Crichton's, a fully listed FTSE fledgling company, and an undiscovered Jim Slater Zulu stock, in my opinion. Can you put the product chart up, please? Crichton's make consumer products, mainly hair and skin care. This year, branded goods were 43% of the business, up 157%. Private label and contract manufacturing are 57% of the business. That's down 7% this year. They're moving to higher margin branded goods with organic growth and acquisitions, mainly buying with cash, so no huge share dilution. The market cap is 73 million at a share price of 110 pence a share. There's no net debt and they pay half a penny in divvy. There are no forecasts, but the move to branded goods increases margins and acquisition boosts increase sales. Performance slide, please. Bernard Johnson, the managing director, recently said on PI World that they'll go from 60 million sales in 2021 to at least 100 million sales by 2024, so 18% compound sales growth over 3 years. He also said margins will go from 8.7% to over 10%. Bernard Johnson passes the wife's shifty eye test in flying colours. 14 million sales this year were from sanitizer, a one-off benefit of COVID, but they also had 1.6 million in COVID costs that won't recur. These two items should more or less cancel each other out. If you strip off the one-off sanitizer sales of 14 million, then the normalized sales for last year were 47 million. Now, if they do 100 million sales by 2024, as Johnson promises, then sales will rise over 100% in 3 years, or 28% compound, based on 47 million normalized sales. That's the minimum, according to Johnson. Growth will be organic, but also from two recent acquisitions. The first, Emma Hardy, a premium brand skincare company, recently bought for 6.4 million. That was 5 million in existing cash and 1.6 million in shares. In the past 2 weeks, they've acquired Brody and Stone. And my immediate reaction was, why buy a couple of TV cops from the 80s? But no, this is another skincare company. Crichton's previously acquired the product Balance Active Formula from Brody and Stone, which has proved very successful. Brody and Stone were purchased for 4.8 million. That was 3.7 million in cash and 1 million shares. Crichton's planned a £20 million acquisition spree with cash from sale of the freehold land that they have and a credit facility of 7 million. So there may be another 8 million in acquisitions to come, perhaps. The 5-year compound annual growth rates on all metrics are stunning. Revenues up 24%, operating profits up 57%, cash up 52%, EPS growth up 47%, and operating margins over 5 years up from 2.6% to 8.75%. Why is this a good investment? Well, they have skin in the game. Four directors hold 42% of the shares. There has been hardly any director selling in 10 years and just 10% dilution in 5 years. Crichton's meets all the Jim Slater Zulu principle requirements, including the something new with these acquisitions. A lot of companies get touted as Zulus, but few have the something new which Jim Slater insisted on. PE for this year? Well, they did 5.9p EPS last year. Even if that 47% compound growth rate over 5 years halved, that would still be 7.3% EPS, excluding acquisitions. Acquisitions could add a further 1p EPS to H2, making 8 PS for the year for 2022. A P of 14 for this year, possibly, and already 7 months into 2022. Around 10p EPS or more for 2023 looks possible, with the acquisitions adding around 2 million profit in a year or so's time, perhaps. So a 2023 PE of 11 or less, perhaps, for a strong double-digit growth. Interim results are in November or December. So the risks. Well, controlling the acquisitions and expansion is one, though Nick Coleman joining recently brings a lot of experience. Nick Coleman is a former Swallowfield PLC guy and has been working in the industry in the US. He has experience to help scale up to a more automated business. Big boy competition trying to muscle in is a possibility. If the products cause health issues, it would be a negative, and a consumer slowdown might reduce the growth rate. The management haven't put a foot wrong in 10 years, though, so back good management, I say. This has been a 40-bagger in 10 years under this management. If it 10 bags from here, the market cap will still be under 750 million. If I'm right, there's some strong growth from a Zulu stock here on a forward PE of around 11 for 2023 by my estimates and a very low peg. Zulus tend to have PEs in the 20s, so there could be some serious re-rating in my opinion. It also has a Stockopedia quality rating of 92, an excellent global marketing director in Pippa Clark, a future possible CEO in my opinion as well. So all in all, a great little company. It's under the radar for a lot of people. It doesn't show up as a Zulu on Stockopedia, and I think it could be a very good investment over the next few years.
Tremendous. Thank you very much, Richard. Andy, do you have any questions?
Yeah, Richard, I was listening to that, and you know, I was thinking to myself of Jay's Group, you know, which had a fantastic growth for a while, Swallowfield, which had fantastic growth for a while, and both stocks then declined because the end markets they were selling into, primarily the supermarkets, actually kind of ate their lunch. You know, how can this company really protect itself from, as it gets bigger, from the customers that it's actually dealing with?
Well, the thing is they're going for more for sales via direct marketing and also on companies that have got good online sales. So, yeah, a couple of the products they've purchased have got sales through Superdrug and Boots, but a lot more of their sales are going to go directly online, which increases the margins for them. And I think, you know, we're in a different age to Swallowfield and maybe some of the other old companies like McBride. I look at them and they're a lot of white label stuff. And all that is, you know, it's low margin business. When you actually go into branded stuff, they're one of the companies they've bought, Emma Hardy. Some of their products sell for tiny little 90 gram pot, 60 quid, 47 quid for a little tiny pot of, you know, brand stuff that girls love to rub on their face and do stuff with, you know, in their rooms. I don't know, but, you know, with my wife, if we were starving to death, she'd still go out and buy her favourite eyeline pencil. So it's one of those areas where I think there's a lot of demand, and with online sales and direct sales a lot more featuring rather than supermarkets, then I think it's one to back, especially with their track record.
Thank you very much. Judith, do you have a question?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's a bit like a private company. How do you get your head around their corporate governance statement, which actually openly says that they don't have any independence? They've got three MDs. It's not bad going, I think. They've got a chair CEO. They've got a NED that was actually the exec FD, and they've got a NED that's the company secretary. There's no limit on the period of office. You know, if you're going to cross all the boxes in terms of governance, they pretty much do it, which, you know, some investors would maybe take a view on and say that it's fine because they're pretty much owner managed. But if they want to be a grown up company at some stage, they're going to have to sort that aspect out, aren't they?
Yeah, I think, you know, there are issues with it being such a small company and the way it's run. But when you get the fledgling sort of footsie fledglings, there's a few companies that don't seem to be up there with the governance that you find further up. But I think further down the line, Bernard Johnson and the chairman, William McElvoy, they're both 75. I think that the plan is for the company's going to get sold out at some point. They're not going to be there forever. Pippa Clark, I think, will be a future CEO. And I think as they get bigger, they're going to move into a bigger company, a proper company. They're small at the moment, but if you want to catch them when they're small, these are some of the things you have to, you know, some of the things you have to take, I think. I know it's probably difficult for fund managers with big pots of money that trying to to get shares in a stock that's only got a market cap so small. And that may be an issue for fund managers. But I think their track record is proven over 10 years. They've done a really good job. Few companies managed to achieve, you know, such a growth rate. And sometimes you've got to back management, I think, and they've done quite good.
Thank you very much. And Stephen, do you have a question?
Yeah, did some primary research, rummaged around the bathroom, where we have actually got a Crichton's product, say we, the fiance, some kind of body scrub, so I didn't realise we actually had it. And I think to get the highest rating for these things, I mean, I quite like the space. I've owned Warpaint London since IPO, which has been on a right roller coaster, and they're on a pretty heroic P at the moment of north of 30 times. The question I've got is, are these brands in the genuine sense of the word, or are they trading names? To get the kind of elevated multiples, the Revlons, it has to be really, really strong brands. I mean, Emma Hardy sounds like that, but I suppose the number of the question is, what is the strategy of adding to the stable of brands? Does it help when they're talking to Superdrugs that they've already got a couple of listings, so then when they buy another company, it's a fait accompli that they'll get that listed in there as well? Just trying to understand this kind of conglomeration approach.
Well, I think, you know, if you've already got so many, you know, like you say, they've already got some brands, but they're moving from a lot of the white label stuff onto branded goods. Branded goods have got far higher margins. And the Emma Hardy ones, I think that's just tip of the iceberg. They've paid a lot of money for Emma Hardy. They've paid about £6 million pound for what is basically hardly any profits at all. But the gains that can be had from it, from what they say, is huge, because they can literally bring that production in house. The margins increase through that. Then they can cross sell with other products that they've got. They can increase the product line. So I think we're having a stable of, I think, our genuine brands. Some of the stuff that the other company that I've just bought is Brodie & Stone. It's like they're selling through Superdrug, and they seem to have quite a following. But the Emma Hardy one has definitely got a big following. It seems to, you know, when I said to the niece, have you heard of Emma Hardy? She said, oh, yeah, I know those. So it's for a small company that they've bought, they've got quite a bit of coverage. So I think there's the scope there to cross-sell, and also the synergies as well. So for me, it's something that I think they can do, going by their past history.
Thanks very much, Richard. So, Andy, give us your comments on the stock and on the pitch, and a score for each.
Okay, it's quite interesting. Stephen's point about brands and trading names. I mean, I remember Mike Ashley saying to me that unless it had been around for 100 years, it wasn't a brand. And all these companies tend to create brands and think they are brands. But I think I probably want to see maybe a couple of years of organic growth. You know, I'm always a bit suspicious of companies making a lot of acquisitions. But against that, like Stephen, I like the space. I've got, you know, Warpaint, I think, we're their largest holder. And so I know the margins you can make potentially in this. I'll definitely have a look at it. I thought the pitch was interesting, probably too much on the financials as compared to, you know, the previous pitch on Wise about the overall market. So I'll go for a 3 and a 3.
Tremendous. Thank you. And Judith?
I don't think it's a bad little company. Aside from my governance point, what I don't really, for me, I want to be able to try and forecast the margins, and I always want to be able to do that on a SKU basis. I know that's maybe much more detailed than they'd ever give out, but just going back to Andy's point, you know, you want to see where the quality of the earnings are coming from. And at the moment, the way they split it down, you can't really see where that margin is coming from. So I think on that basis, it's not going to be one for me, because at some stage they will be under a bit more pressure in certain of these products. And it would also be quite good to know really which ones are the true brands per se that are achieving the higher margins as well. But, you know, a return on capital of consistently over sort of 18-19% isn't bad. I would say it's a 3.5 for the company, and same again for the pitch, a good, well-delivered pitch.
Thank you very much. And Stephen?
I'd like to see them secure the services of a broker. I think it does help to unlock value, albeit they're doing some good things with the private investor community, but as the next stage of their professionalization, and you know, better shareholder returns do correlate to having at least one broker than zero broker. But yeah, there's a lot to admire. Just slightly put off with the price as it stands today. I think it's been a little bit squeezed, but it's hard to argue with those historic CAGRs, particularly the EPS line and operating profit line as well. So I think it's dangerous to bet against these guys. I didn't know we were allowed half points, so I'm going to go for half points as well, Judith. Three and a half on the quality of the company. I thought Andy was right on the pitch, understandably heavy on the financials. It would have been 3.5, but you threw in an excellent joke there. And I do like me jokes, so the Brodie and Stone joke elevated the pitch to a 4.
Tremendous. Thank you very much indeed, Stephen. So you got a 10 for the stock and a 10.5 for the pitch. So we come to the moment that you've been waiting for. Who has sold it to the city? And obviously there are 3 sets of scores for the stock and for the pitch, and then a combination of them both. If we look at the pitch of the stock itself, in third place, with 6 out of 15, we have Ryan with TransferWise. And then equal in second place, we have John with Brave Bison and Reb with Springfield Properties with 8 out of 15. In first place with 10, Richard with Crichton's. And then in terms of the pitch itself, we have in fourth place, John with 7 out of 15. And in third place, Richard with 10.5 out of 15. And in second place, Reb with 11 out of 15. And in first place, Ryan with 12 out of 15. Congratulations, Ryan. But then what we've all been waiting for is overall, who is the winner? And in fourth place with 15 out of 30, we have John. And in third place with 18 out of 30, we have Ryan. And in second place with 19 out of 30, we have Reb. And in first place, we have Richard with 20.5 out of 30. Richard, congratulations. We very much hope that you'll come back for the next episode of Sell It to the City. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And thanks to everyone else. It was very good. I thought everybody's pitch was very good.
So enormous thanks to everyone, our panel, Andy Brough, without whom this would not have happened, to Judith McKenzie and to Stephen English, and to our superb investors. Honestly, you did a fantastic job. John Marriott, Rebecca Stewart, Ryan Rahim Akia, and Richard Crowe. We are absolutely delighted. It's been a superb evening. And thank you to everyone for watching. I hope it's been informative and fun. And please give us your comments on the various social media platforms and find more investing entertainment at piworld.co.uk. See you next time.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.